Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and new chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Deva Sobel. Deva Sobel is the acclaimed author of New York Times and internationally best-selling titles, including Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. In her 30 years as a science journalist, she has written for many magazines, including Audubon, Discover, Life, and The New Yorker. Served as a contributing editor to Harvard Magazine and Omni, and co-authored 5 books, including Is Anyone Out There? With astronomer Frank Drake. Deva received the 2001 Individual Public Service Award from the National Science Board for fostering awareness of science and technology among broad segments of the general public. Also in 2001, the Boston Museum of Science gave her its prestigious Bradford Washburn Award for her outstanding contribution toward public understanding of science, appreciation of its fascination, and the valid role it plays in all our lives. On October 2004, in London, Deva received the Harrison Medal from the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers in recognition of her contribution to increasing awareness of the science of horology by the general public through her writing and lecturing. In 2008, the Astronomical Society of the Pacific gave her its Clampt Roberts Award for increasing the public understanding and appreciation of astronomy. From January through March 2006, Deva served as a Robert Vail nonfiction writer in residence at the University of Chicago, where she taught a seminar in science writing while pursuing research on her new project, a stage play about 16th century astronomer Nicholas Copernicus called And the Sun Stood Still. Her play was commissioned by Manhattan Theater Club through the Alfred P. Sloan Initiative and was also supported by a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. In May 2011, as the Elizabeth Kirkpatrick Dundas Visiting Artist and Scholar, Deva taught a course called Writing Creatively About Science at Mary Boulding College in Staunton, Virginia. Starting in 2013, she will be in a 2-year appointment as a Joanne Lehman Jacobson writer-in-residence at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Deva's presentation today is based on her new book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. Please join me in welcoming Deva Sobel.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I'm very excited to be here. Oh, there I am. Excited to be here and to talk to you about this project. I have 2 stories tonight. One is the story of Copernicus, and one is my story of how I came to write this play within a book about him. I had been working on the play for years. I actually got the idea in 1973 because that was the 500th anniversary year of his birth. And I still remember reading an article about him in Sky and Telescope. I still have that issue, in fact, which talked about how he finally got convinced to publish his insane idea. And I thought that meeting, he was involved with a stranger who came to talk to him about his ideas, who pushed him to do what he'd avoided doing his whole life. And I thought that should really be a play. But here he is, pictured in front of his sun-centered plan for the cosmos, which at that time was a most unpopular idea. And he actually got the notion as a relatively young man, and he wrote about it to a few people he knew would be interested. This was how scientists disseminated their ideas in an age before scientific journals. They wrote letters, and then the scientists who received those letters could copy them over and send them to other people, and the ideas spread around slowly. And so he outlined his plan that he thought would make a lot more sense for the Earth to be in motion around the sun, even though it really doesn't seem to be moving, and that he was at work on a big book that would explain the whole idea, give all the background math, and that would come eventually. So people began to know that he was at work on this project. Some people think that it took Columbus, who actually made his voyages while Copernicus was a college student, that it was Columbus who convinced everybody that the Earth is round. This is a fiction that was created by Washington Irving in the 19th century. People have always known the Earth is round. It is really obvious, because if you travel very far from north to south, you see different stars coming up, and you see ships sailing away. They disappear from the bottom up, and when they come home, they appear from the top down. And every now and then, this happens. This is a lunar eclipse, and you actually see the shadow of the round Earth falling on the surface of the moon. And people who watch the sky, and that used to be most people before it became impossible to see the sky anymore, people have been observing eclipses and recording them and predicting them since before the 8th century BC. The written records go back that far. It isn't dark enough in here for you to see just how beautiful this picture is, but maybe it's better like this, because this more closely approximates what happens when you try to look at the sky now. But even if you had a view as good as this, you would be hard-pressed to figure out that the Earth is turning. From our vantage point on this planet, it really looks as though everything else is moving around us. And we don't have any sense that we are moving. I mean, if you throw something in the air, it doesn't land 100 feet behind you. So how could we be moving? And these kinds of common sense notions of stability really made Copernicus worry about publishing his idea widely, because it sounded so implausible. Copernicus actually had a predecessor on the notion of a sun-centered system, and that was Aristarchus in the 3rd century BC. I hate those imagined pictures of what ancient Greek astronomers looked like, so I'm showing you the real Aristarchus here, which is his crater on the moon. And he wrote a book about this idea that the Earth was actually in motion around the sun, and he understood that that meant that the stars would have to be much farther away than people thought, because for the Earth to go all the way around the sun every year, you would see some change in the stars. They would look bigger or smaller or closer together, and we don't see that. So Aristarchus understood all of those things. The problem was his book disappeared in antiquity. Another book he wrote on the sizes and distances of the sun and moon survived. And Copernicus read that book. But the only trace of Aristarchus's sun-centered system was in a book by Archimedes called The Sand Reckoner, in which he refers to Aristarchus's idea and explains it in a long paragraph. But that book did not come into Europe and get translated into Latin and published until the year after Copernicus died. So he didn't know about that part of Aristarchus's work. Archimedes, of course, said that if he had a lever and a place to stand, he could move the earth. But that was a different kind of motion. So here is Copernicus on his sun-centered system. And this is Ptolemy, who was the reigning authority in astronomy. He'd written a book in the 2nd century that was still considered the authoritative word on astronomy in Copernicus's time, which was late 15th through the middle of the 16th century. And even Ptolemy had once said that in some way it would make more sense for the Earth to move than to try to think of all the stars and planets all going around this one tiny little sphere, except that the motion of the Earth was too ridiculous even to consider. So Ptolemy's book made mathematical explanations for the motions of the planets. And it violated an ancient belief about the heavenly motions, that they should proceed with uniform speed in perfect circles. And, of course, they don't really move that way. So if you're looking from the Earth and you're trying to create a system that accounts for all their motions, you've got to bend the rules somewhere. And Ptolemy did that. And so he figured the motions from a point that wasn't really the center. And this really bothered the Arabic astronomers of the 13th century. And they worked to revise Ptolemy's math. And Copernicus definitely saw this work. He was a student at a time when manuscripts were coming to Europe from all over the world, and he was aware of this work and actually lifted it for his own calculations. However, the Islamic astronomers never switched places between the Earth and the Sun. They didn't see any need to do that. That was what Copernicus did. Somehow he saw the footprint of the Earth's motion in the patterns of the other planets, and he just tried it to see what would happen. And when he put the sun at the center, the planets lined up in order of their speed, which must have struck him as something totally wonderful, because it gave a reason for the planets to have different speeds. It had something to do with their distance from the sun. Before that switch, people didn't know the order of the planets. If the Earth is at the center, then the moon is the first thing to go around. And after that, you are hard-pressed to say whether it's Mercury or Venus or the sun. When you get beyond that, the rest of the order works out, but it's foggy in the middle. But with the sun at the center, it made complete sense. And so he had a fully developed system, which must have struck him as reality. And in his time, people didn't think you could discover anything real or true about the heavens. So for him to think that he understood the actual structure of the universe was a gigantic claim. So I'm going to go back and tell you his story now. He was born in Torun. He was one of four children, and they were all orphaned at an early age. He was the youngest child. And his mother's brother was a church official, and he took over the care of the children. So he married off the eldest daughter, made the other daughter a nun, and put the two boys through university in Krakow. And although he had an illegitimate child of his own, he really saw his young nephew as a brilliant, talented youth and was hoping to bring him into the church and have him be the bishop someday. So the university in Krakow was called the Jagiellonian University, and today there is this beautiful statue of Copernicus imagined as a student there. And see, he was already interested in astronomy. No, he really was. And the way people know this is his library survives. And while he was a student, he made himself a book. He bought several sets of astronomical tables and some blank pages and had all of that bound together so that he could make his own observations. And he carried that interest through the rest of his life. This is the rest of his library, all these books. He collected books through his life. He gave some of them away, but this was what remained at his death. And it was kept in the cathedral library where he lived. But the library was invaded by the Swedish during the 30 Years' War, and all of Copernicus's books were taken to Sweden, where they are today, at the university library in Uppsala, where this photograph was made. This photograph was actually taken by Charles Eames. And this book in the front is a book, a calendar of eclipses. So it predicted lunar and solar eclipses and showed, you know, how much of the body would be eclipsed. And Copernicus kept this book and made notes in it every time he observed an eclipse. And I'm going to talk about this book again later. So after his university education, he was sent to graduate school in Italy, first to law school to learn canon law, to continue grooming him for his church career. He had already become a canon of the church, thanks to his uncle, who had become the bishop. So lots of nepotism here. And then the church sent him to Padua to study medicine so that he could be the bishop's personal physician. And although Copernicus never says what he thought of astrology and whether he ever made any predictions himself, astrology was very important at that time. It was the reason you cared about where the planets were, and it also figured in medicine because each part of the body was governed by a different zodiac sign. And a doctor needed to know the patient's horoscope to make an accurate diagnosis and also a prescription and a time of administering the prescription. And then Copernicus went back to Poland to a town that was called Frauenburg in his time. Now it's Frombork. And he went to live in the bishop's palace to be his uncle's secretary and personal physician. And his first independent act was to make a translation, do a real humanist service. And he translated a Greek text into Latin and had it published and dedicated to his uncle, the bishop. And this is it. And almost immediately after he did that, he somehow told his uncle that he had no desire to follow in his footsteps. And he moved out of the palace to live with the other canons near the cathedral and pursue his astronomy. You recognize this person? This is Owen Gingrich at Harvard University. He's emeritus now. But Copernicus's great book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres had been dismissed by Arthur Koestler and the Sleepwalkers as the book nobody read. And Gingrich thought that probably wasn't true. And he has made a lifetime career of tracking down all the extant copies of Copernicus's book and has been able to prove that everybody read his book. And he's made notes of who owned the copies and who marked them up and what kinds of notations appear. And Gingrich was getting ready to publish his long adventure story on this quest, and he asked me to read his manuscript. And I got excited about the Copernicus story all over again and determined that I would write my play after all. So I have Owen Gingrich to thank for the re-inspiration. And I thought I would call the play And the Sun Stood Still, because that was the text from, first of all, Copernicus made the sun stand still in his theory, but that was the text from the book of Joshua that he most worried about, because he knew people who didn't understand astronomy would use the Bible against him, twist chapter and verse to discredit him. And one of the questions he most expected to be asked was, if the sun is standing still at the center, as you claim, why did Joshua have to tell it to stand still? So that has been the title of my play all along. The play itself has changed many, many times. It's been rewritten more times than I care to admit or remember. But this was the impetus. It was about 30 years after I had the idea, and I figured I'm older and braver, and I could learn how to write a play. One of the first things I wanted to do was go to Poland and see all the places Copernicus had lived, because he left a very thin historical record. There's his book, there are some other pieces that he published about astronomy, but there are only 17 letters. And Galileo left 1,000 letters. So 17 letters is not much to conjure with. And I was looking for anything else that would help me get to know him better. Of course, I had a fantasy of returning to Poland at a time like this, his time. He lived up on the northern coast here. And this was 2005 now when I was planning my trip, and I was on an eclipse trip to see an eclipse in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And one night at dinner, I sat next to a young Polish mining engineer, and I told him I was going to be making a trip to his country. I was working on a project about Copernicus. And are any of you here amateur astronomers? I know you're out there, yeah, okay. And I've always maintained that amateur astronomers are the most generous people. They just love to take the telescope out somewhere and have people who've never looked through one come by and get a thrill. So I'm chatting with this young man about my trip, and it didn't take him 5 minutes to say, you must give me the dates of your travel. I will get the time off work, and I will be your translator and guide. And I had no idea how much I would need a translator and guide. So it was really a good thing that he offered to do that for me. And he actually did it twice and refused any kind of payment, just a wonderful companion. And here he is, my two favorite men in Poland. It's... name is Thomas Mazur, and we saw many wonderful things together. All the castles where the knights lived, the Birthplace Museum. This is the curator of the museum in Turin, Turun, where Copernicus was born. And I don't know if I'm the only one who feels this way, but even her hair, you know, she seems to have gone out of her way to identify with him. But she was very, very helpful. Spoke no English, but we had a great time there. And then traveled to Frombork. This is the view from the wall that surrounds the cathedral. And you enter the fortification wall through this gateway. And the gateway actually has one of those grates with points on the bottom that can suddenly fall down. This is the church begun in the 13th century. And this is a Pentateuch that was created while Copernicus worked at the church. It's got real gold on it. This was something he would have seen every day. This is another a letter. It's not the one in his handwriting, but it's another example of an idea he had about the motion of the stars that he wrote as a letter to a friend, and it got circulated among other astronomers. And that kind of activity is what made Copernicus's reputation known, even though he had no kind of university affiliation, no community of scholars near him anywhere in Poland that he could talk to about these ideas. Everything was by Latin correspondence. Here he is, as imagined by the painter Jan Matejko in the 19th century. Here's his idea, his church. This painting is called Conversation with God. And this is one of his instruments. He had a few scientific instruments that he made that helped him establish the positions of the planets against the background stars, or in relationship to the moon. And this is the same kind of thing, a replica that is exhibited at the university in Krakow. So it has these little sighting vanes, and you look through those at an object, and as you're sliding this arm along the other one, when you get the object lined up, then you have a reading, an angular measurement above the horizon. This is his tower. It's actually a tower within the fortification wall. There are a few of them so that when the cathedral community was attacked from outside, which happened, the one biggest surprise to me, I think, in doing the research for this project was the idea of active warfare, that he actually had to defend the cathedral against the Knights of the Teutonic Order when they rode in on a marauding mission. And today this is set up as though he lived in it. He did live in it sometimes when there was danger outside, but he actually had his own house outside the cathedral walls, and he had a flat area that he created where he could set up the instruments and do his observing. And these are real cannonballs. These were in the basement of the bishop's palace. A real graphic proof of what he was doing. Another thing he was doing was dealing with the peasants. The church owned all the land and would rent it out to the peasants so they could raise their crops and animals. So this is an image from a book of hours from that period. And the peasants nominally owned their parcels of land, so they could deed them to their children, or they could sell them to a neighbor. And Copernicus had to travel all around these thousands of acres and record every such transaction and collect the rent. And he made notes of all the transactions. And that was something I found very useful to help establish his character, because you can see in the way he settled disputes among the peasants that he was extremely fair to them. He always took their personal hardships into account. Elderly people without children got a break. People who'd been injured got a reduction in rent. Some people who had other problems got an extra sack of grain, or they got a horse. He found ways to help them out. This is where he lived when he was the administrator of the southern lands and collecting the rents. And this is all bricked over, but this was open in his day, this part. And his apartment was at the back of this section. And on the wall that was open to the light, he fashioned this sundial. It was blue and red when it was new. And with this instrument, he was able to figure out the exact length of the year. This was another big problem. There were problems with the calendar. The length of the year had been miscalculated, so Easter was falling out of sync with the seasons, and the popes were eager for calendar reform and were periodically asking all the astronomers to contribute their ideas on how to fix the calendar. So he was working on that. He was also interested in economics, because in the process of collecting all this money from the peasants and seeing the kind of currency that was circulating, he realized all the abuses of the coinage. So there were minting privileges in many cities, and local governors could just issue new coins whenever they felt like it with a lower content of silver. And you can imagine what happens then. The coins have the same face value as the others, but they weigh less and have less silver. So the smart people hoard the coins with the more silver in them, because they can always take them to the goldsmith and get them melted down. And they spend the less valuable ones. And Copernicus wrote a treatise on that and other problems with the coinage. And his idea is today known as Gresham's Law, that bad money drives good money out of circulation. But Gresham, who was a contemporary of his, published first. So it's Gresham's Law, not Copernicus's Law. And this is just another 19th century image of what he must have looked like presenting his monetary treatise to the Polish Senate. They actually listened to him and implemented his changes. And right around the time Copernicus was writing this treatise about money, Martin Luther published his complaints about church practices. This is a portrait by Lucas Cranach, the elder, famous painting. And things really began to change in Europe. And Copernicus, being Catholic, working for the Catholic Church, soon felt the pressure of the new evangelist religion. And neighboring bishops sometimes converted to Lutheranism. And so Copernicus's diocese became more and more isolated. Meanwhile, his idea got more and more widely known. This map was published in the early 1530s, so a good 10 years before his book finally came out. You see up here at the North Pole and down at the South, there are little crank handles on the earth, and these little cherubs actually turning the cranks. So the idea is abroad that maybe the earth is not quite as stationary as people have thought. And in 1539, Copernicus suddenly received a visit from a young German mathematician. Now, again, there are no real pictures of him, but I found this British theater student who created his own Rheticus costume. And Rheticus probably looked something like that. He was that age. He was 25 years old, probably similar in coloring, and that's what he would have worn. So he showed up at Copernicus's door, having heard about this idea, and he was an outcast because the bishop had grown so paranoid that he had issued an edict banishing Lutherans from the diocese. And the last thing Copernicus needed was a heretic in his house. He was already in trouble with the bishop because of his female housekeeper. The bishop was leaning heavily. Three of the 17 letters are about the bishop's anger and outrage over the presence of this unmarried woman in his house, and so he was forced to send her away. He no sooner gets rid of her than the Lutheran arrives to encourage him to publish the book he has avoided publishing all this time. This, the meeting that I so wanted to dramatize. And by some finagling, they managed to keep Rheticus in residence for 2 years. So he obviously convinces Copernicus to do this. He brings him observations of the planet Mercury that Copernicus had not been able to make himself, so that was another encouragement. And he also wrote his own summary of Copernicus's theory and had it published just to see what would happen. You know, what would the reaction be? And this is it. And this, too, is written as a letter to the man who told Rheticus about Copernicus's ideas. And it's called The First Report. And they got this published in 1541, and nothing happened. The world didn't explode. So that was another inducement to Copernicus to publish the full-blown treatise. While Rheticus was with him, they observed a couple of eclipses. They had a lot of work to do on the manuscript. One thing Rheticus had to do was actually copy the entire manuscript. It's a great big book. It's 400 pages printed. But Copernicus obviously did not want to part with his original. He had it his entire life, and he insisted on keeping it. It's another artist's imagined view of Copernicus working on the book. And here he is drawing the system. This is another instrument of his, an armillary sphere. So this manuscript still survives, which is so unlikely. There are no manuscripts of any of Galileo's books, and Galileo was later, because at that time, in the printing process, the manuscript got divided, distributed among the various typesetters, and each one worked on his part and then threw the pages away. So the manuscript no longer existed once there was a printed book. But Copernicus insisted on keeping his. And Tom and I got permission to see it. It's kept in a safe, temperature controlled, humidity controlled. The book today, if you find one at auction, it costs upwards of $2 million. So, what price do we put on the original manuscript? That's why they keep it in a safe. And, of course, for its own protection from insects, floods. And we were able to request several openings of the manuscript. It's bound. And a curator brought it in with white gloves on. Usually, rare book curators do not wear gloves because they will explain to you that gloves make you clumsy and you're more likely to tear the pages. But this, she was wearing white gloves and opened the book to this page. In the real manuscript, not only shows the diagram, but he continues writing around the diagram. It's beautifully done in his tiny, neat handwriting. And when we saw this page, we both gasped because there's a hole in the middle of the page, right there, and this is why. If you draw 8 concentric circles with a pair of compasses, you get a hole in the middle of the page, and that really, that was the moment I felt I'd seen him brush through the room. And then it was over, and we had to leave. And walking out of the building, Tom said, "It was just like an eclipse. It was over too soon, but you'll never forget it." So this is the real thing. And Owen Gingrich says it reads a little bit like an eye chart at the beginning, smaller and smaller. And it came out finally in 1543 while Copernicus lay dying. The printing process took a long time, and partway through he suffered a stroke. So although at first he'd been receiving the pages as they were finished and proofreading them, once he had the stroke he couldn't do that anymore. And he was paralyzed on the right side, and then couldn't speak, and just gradually deteriorated, but was still alive when the last bit came. And his caretaker, one of the other canons, reported in a letter that he put the final pages in his hands, and then he died. And I worried about whether to put that in the play, that it was just so melodramatic that it would be completely unbelievable, maybe even offensive. But well, you'll see how that sorts out. So because Copernicus had been worried about the reception of his book, he dedicated it to the Pope. So the opening dedication letter in the book is directed to Paul III. And in it, he explains how anxious he has been, how the scorn that he had to fear kept him from publishing, had almost made him put the work aside. And it was only because his friends pushed him and pushed him that he finally acceded and published his book. And by dedicating it to the Pope, he was hoping to show that there was nothing irreverent about what he was saying, and he had no malicious intent, that people would recognize the Pope as an authority in all things. It's questionable how much of an authority on astronomy he was. He had his own personal astrologer. He also had several illegitimate children and had made his teenage grandsons cardinals. So, a different time. And this is another very famous painting by Titian. And this was made in May of 1543 at the time that Copernicus was dying. So here's the system again as it appeared in the published book. And The book did not cause a great furor right away. During the printing process, Redicus, who was supposed to proofread the whole thing, got a better job offer and turned over the final proofreading to someone he knew in Nuremberg who had been a Catholic priest but converted and was now a Lutheran minister with a strong interest in astronomy, and who had been in correspondence with Copernicus while he was writing the book, and had tried to convince him to go easy with this idea, to not present it as reality. And Copernicus didn't listen to him. He had spent the whole first part of the book explaining the sun is in the center, the earth is in motion, everything makes better sense this way, and then he went into the mathematics in the later pages. Now this person is in charge of the printing of the book. So he wrote his own anonymous preface, which said, don't take any of this too seriously. You know, this is just another way of thinking about the calculations. And it's no worse than other people's methods, better than most, but it's not reality. And anybody who expects the truth from astronomy will leave this subject a bigger fool than when he entered it. So that was the first thing you saw when you opened the book. And that protected the book from a lot of criticism. It also led to an interesting situation, which is that the first owners of the book didn't make any notations in that first part. They just skipped over it. They went right to the math, and that's where all the heavy-duty marginalia is. So, also, the book was written in Latin. It's a spherical geometry textbook. It's not something the average person would read. It was intended for a very scholarly audience. So only those people were reading it. It wasn't until Galileo made his early telescopic discoveries that he realized Copernicus had not only been serious about the suggestion, but that he was correct, because there were moons going around Jupiter. So the Earth was obviously not the only center of revolution in the cosmos. And if Jupiter could carry four moons with it on its revolutions, then certainly the Earth could carry just one moon. That was a big objection to the Earth's motion. What would happen to the moon? So Galileo began lecturing publicly in Italian and writing in Italian for the benefit of intelligent laymen who could not afford a university education. And this is what got the church so upset. And so they began to put pressure on Galileo to silence himself about these things. He traveled to Rome in 1616 to argue, because he knew that the church was on the verge of banning Copernicus's book, and he had friends who were cardinals. He went around buttonholing people, don't do this, that we're discovering new things every day that lend credence to what Copernicus said. If you make it illegal for Catholics to read this book, the Protestants will figure out the universe and the church will be embarrassed. That was his argument. And they didn't listen to him. And Copernicus's book got listed on the index as suspended until corrected. 4 years later, in 1620, the index published the changes that you were supposed to make in Copernicus's book if you owned a copy. And Galileo made the changes in his copy. And outside of Italy, Owen Gingrich has been able to show that nobody bothered because there were no consequences. Why would they? And so even with the corrections published, the book remained suspended until corrected on the index for 200 years. And then when Galileo wrote his dialogue, that too went on the index and stayed on there with Copernicus till 1835. You may have heard a few years ago, archaeologists in Poland decided to rip up the floor of the cathedral and see if they could find his body. And they found, they knew the position of his altar and looked near the altar. And sure enough, there was the skull of a 70-year-old man, which was his age at death, and other bones that matched the skull. So the fragments were given to a police forensic artist who came up with this image of what he probably looked like in old age, except they still couldn't really prove that the bones belonged to Copernicus. There had been hope that a DNA analysis might show a connection between the bones and the descendants of his married sister. She has descendants to the present day. But that didn't work out. And then one of the astronomers at Uppsala recalled looking at Copernicus's copy of the eclipse calendar and that there were hairs in the binding. And the hairs were in decent enough shape to be analyzed, and they matched, two of them matched the tooth that was in the skull fragment. So that was a definitive identification. And then they had to bury him again. Catholic country, you know. So he has a big fancy tomb now and a new marker, and there was a wonderful ceremony. This took place in May of 2010, and the Primate of Poland presided at the Mass. And nowadays we see statues of him everywhere. This is one of my favorites. This is outside the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. And while I was working on the play, my publisher spoke to me, said, "You've done all of this research. Why don't you write a book around the play? And you could tell the whole story in narrative nonfiction, lead up to the meeting that everyone knows happened, knows took place, even though nobody knows what they said to each other. And then after the play, pick up the story and tell what happened up to the present time." And that seemed like a great idea to me. And the process of writing the book and telling the whole story without making anything up was a great relief to me, because I could stop worrying about what Copernicus might think of what I was putting in his mouth in the play. And so having done that, I, with greater confidence, went back and rewrote the play, and it was able to get a lot more dramatic. So the book is now a strange hybrid, a book with a play in the middle, something different. And Copernicus is remembered as, or thought of today, as the great diminisher, that he took the earth out of the center of the universe. So he somehow diminished our importance. But at the time, people didn't see things that way. The earth was a pit of all the heavy stuff that was not heavenly and wonderful. It was the place where things changed and died and decayed. And to take that and make it a wandering star was a real stretch for people, aside from the fact of the Earth's motion. And then to take the sun, this wonderful light of all creation, and put it in the center where all the miserable dregs of humanity had been, that was also a very difficult concept. But that's what he did, and eventually everyone had to accept it. And then later we found out that not only are we not at the center of the solar system, we're not at the center of the galaxy. We're certainly not at the center of the universe. We are not even made of the stuff that composes most of the universe. So we are diminished beyond what Copernicus might ever have conceived. So where does that leave us? Are we really diminished? Or are we maybe a little exalted by virtue of being rare? So maybe we need to try to live up to that and take really good care of this place. So, well, thank you. Those are all the things I want to show you, but I would love to talk more if you have questions. We do have microphones.
Yes. Well, thanks to Deva for her comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, with Deva Sobel. Now, we open up for a Q&A. It's already 7 p.m., so we will take a few questions. We have two standing microphones if you like to. Well, I can just pass around. We'll take three questions, so.
Could you talk about how quickly his theory became accepted and
yes.
became used by the church for prediction of holidays and saints' days?
Yes. His mathematics was accepted right away. So by 1582, the calendar was reformed, and he had contributed to that. Kepler and Galileo in the early 1600s had read Copernicus's book and felt that he was right. Galileo didn't talk about it right away, but Kepler, being a Lutheran and not worrying about what the church would say, was a very outspoken Copernican. But many astronomers couldn't accept it. The church's own astronomers, although they corroborated Galileo's discoveries, they couldn't say that the Earth was in motion. So they liked Tycho's idea of a system where all the other planets went around the sun, but then that whole business went around the Earth. And many people clung to that, probably up till the time of Newton in the late 17th century. And the church really didn't get comfortable with the idea of the sun at the center till the 1700s. And even then, Galileo's book and Copernicus's book remained on the index.
You made a passing mention of Osiander's preface, and there was some controversy from the very beginning. I happen to know that Giordano Bruni, in the late 16th century, already said that this was a false thing that had not been written by Copernicus. Could you say a little bit about the process by which Osiander's preface was taken out and regarded as not really part of the book?
The anonymous preface written by Andreas Osiander soon was identified by other astronomers. Kepler's copy of Copernicus's book contains an explanation of how he found out who wrote it. It was not removed from the book, but Osiander was outed. People knew who had written it, and that it was not Copernicus's intent. So by the late 16th century, it was established who had written it.
So just a quick comment. It's actually a very good thing that the sun is not at the center of the galaxy now that astronomers know that there's a massive black hole in that location.
Yes. Thank goodness we're not there. Right.
Okay. Maybe one last question. I saw a hand out here.
A small anecdote on a visit to Krakow some years ago. I took a tour of the university there. Jagiellonian University?
Jagiellonian.
And the, yeah. Of course, the guide talked about Copernicus, and I said, what kind of grades did he get here? And the answer was the only record they had of him attending was that he had paid his tuition.
He paid his tuition, exactly, in full.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Deva for her comments here today. We also thank the audience here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th of Enlightened discussion, is adjourned.